Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Anne Shakespeare. Shakespeare received a degree from Cornell's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences in 1977 and graduated from Cornell's Vet School in 1982. In the mid-1980s, she returned to Cornell and did an internship in small animal medicine and surgery. After over 20 years of working as both a farm and small animal vet in various cities, she opened her own practice with partner Christine Armeo in spring of 2006. It's called Cornerstone Veterinary Hospital, located in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Thank you very much.
Now, you said that growing up in the suburbs, you ended up with this great interest in farming. Tell us about that. What aspect of farming?
Well, it seems to me that you always want what you don't have. And as a kid in the suburbs on Long Island, we had woods, and I loved to be in the woods, but we didn't really have farms except for a few sod farms. And it just seemed to me that a farm life would be the perfect life to have as a kid. And so I always sort of yearned for that and the country life. And mm-hmm. So I read a lot about it and imagined it. And
were animals involved with this fantasy about a farm life?
I suppose so, but I wasn't really animal driven when I was younger. I was really interested in just getting out in the country and living a natural country farm life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, animals were part of it, but they weren't the driving force. Mm-hmm. For
and so this took you to the egg school.
Yeah, I actually applied to Cornell knowing that they had a school of agriculture and thinking that I was interested in some type of a farm career, animal sciences, wildlife biology, or even just plain old farming. And it wasn't until I got there that I realized that they had a veterinary college in New York State. And I thought that that would be a way that I could merge both an early interest that I had in medicine, I wanted to be a nurse, with my love of farming. So I went with the idea of possibly becoming a farm vet.
Uh-huh. In your biography, it said that in second grade you wanted to be a nurse, but you didn't know, because you didn't know women could be doctors.
Well, I was born in 55, so I guess I knew, but it didn't seem like a real goal, a realistic career. And so I wanted to be a nurse because that was an acceptable medical career for women. And even though I had a love of farming, I always thought my career would be a medical career,
mm-hmm.
and especially when I was younger. So, it wasn't until much later that I realized, and it wasn't something my parents said. They didn't say, you can't be this, you can't be that. Mm-hmm. It was just our mm-hmm. culture. It wasn't really a goal for a girl. And so later I realized that I could do whatever I wanted to do, including being a doctor or a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you chose veterinarian.
Yes.
Now, your first job as a vet was in rural Cumberland Valley, Pennsylvania.
That's right.
Talk to us about that. You worked with farm animals.
Yep. I was what's called a mixed animal practitioner. So about 50% of my job was farm animals, and the other half was small animals. So typically I would get up in the morning and go out for 4 or 5 hours and do farm animal practice and large animal calls, and then I would come back in the afternoon and do small animal appointments, and then in the evenings, probably 4 out of 5 evenings, I was on emergency duty and saw both large animal emergencies and small animal emergencies.
What kind of emergencies do large animals have? Talk to us a bit about that.
I suppose the biggest emergency we would have is a condition called milk fever, which is when a cow develops low calcium soon after giving birth, and she has this tremendous need to produce milk, particularly dairy cows, because they're bred to produce tons of milk, and all the calcium goes into the milk, and it doesn't leave much circulating in their bloodstream, and they get really weak, and they're down, and they'll die. And so you have to give them intravenous calcium. So it's an easy fix, and you can cure most of them, but it typically happens in the middle of the night out of the furthest farm field that there is.
So that was, you know that from experience.
Yes, I do.
Oh, my goodness. That's, and you said in your biography that you got tired of being knocked around working with big animals.
Yeah. I mean, I was taught that size doesn't matter anymore because, and so that farm animals was an appropriate career for women as it was for men because you didn't have to be big and strong. We had drugs. You could tranquilize your patient. But in reality, you can't tranquilize them for every little thing. You've got to give cows pills, you've got to warm horses, and you can't be tranquilizing them all the time. So for the big procedures, the surgery certainly, but for the small procedures, you have to handle them. And so they kick and they throw their body around, and when they weigh 1,200 pounds, you take a tumble. And so, you know, I got kicked enough times so that I thought, I'd really still like to be walking when I'm 60.
And did you ever really get hurt?
I got hurt enough to cry. I never broke a bone you know, was seriously disabled. I never lost any time from work from it, but the potential was there, and I've known people who have been seriously injured. So I just thought, you know, that in combination with some other factors, I thought I'd rather focus on small animals.
Uh-huh. And when you were working on farms, you worked with the Amish and Mennonite.
Yeah,
clients.
The Cumberland Valley of Pennsylvania has a lot of Amish and Old Order Mennonite farms there.
And were there any special things you had to do because of their traditions in regard to taking care of animals?
Yes, they didn't have electricity, although most of the farms in the area actually sold their milk to Hershey, and so they had to meet typical commercial standards, meaning that they had to have a cooling tank. They didn't make milk for their own consumption, and they consumed what they made, but they also made it for commercial production. So they would have a diesel generator, and often with their diesel generator, they'd have a plug. So I could plug in my clippers if I was doing surgery, but they didn't have light. And so I did many surgeries by kerosene lantern, which a Coleman lantern gives a surprising amount of light.
Yeah, it does.
And they wouldn't have a phone, and this was before cell phones, so all of my calls were by radio. You couldn't call out from an Amish farm if you needed anything.
I was surprised to hear that you actually work with Amish and Mennonites, because I was thinking they would only allow members of their own communities.
They use veterinary services freely. I was more concerned that I was a woman, and in their culture, you know, a woman isn't usually in a position of authority, and I wasn't sure how they would receive my advice or want me treating their animals. But they don't expect people from our culture, which they call the English culture, to be like the Amish. So they had no problem with me being a woman.
And they accepted your authority.
And accepted my authority for their animals, and so it wasn't a problem.
Well, let's talk about the fact that you eventually left the rural setting. And you said in your biography that you thought it was hard to have a knowledge and do a good job working with so many species.
Well, that was, you know, some years ago when I left there. I only did 3 years in rural practice. But even back then, I felt very spread thin. I mean, we did sheep, goats, pigs, cows, horses, dogs, cats, and then an assortment of what we call pocket pets, hamsters and guinea pigs and rabbits. And it's really hard to know everything about all of those species, particularly when certain owners expect that you are top-notch or can offer top-notch treatments. Dog owners, cat owners, and horse owners often look at their animals as more than just an animal. They're a companion. And so it was hard to feel like I was doing a really good job of providing care for particularly those pets with the amount of room that was in my brain to know everything I had to know about the farm animals as well. So I decided to get a little more training in dogs and cats and focus on that and then be comfortable that I was doing the best I could do.
And do people now go into more discipline in regard to just certain species? Has that changed?
They do. They more than with regard to certain species. I mean, there are some cat-only practices now. I haven't heard of any dog-only practices. But most small animal practitioners do both dogs and cats. The focus instead is on specialties within a small animal field. So, for example, ophthalmology, orthopedic surgery, soft tissue surgery, oncology, nutrition. There are all of those subspecialties now for animals.
God, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. And it's a little frightening because the more technical you get, the more the cost goes up. And that, to me, is a real issue in veterinary medicine, is what's available and what you can afford.
Yeah, and so people are learning all these skills that perhaps clients can't even afford.
When you become a specialist, you pretty much are going to have to practice in a metropolitan area where there are enough people to afford your services. You can't practice orthopedic surgery out in the country and expect that majority of clients are going to be able to afford it. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you eventually went back to Cornell and did an internship in small animals and surgery?
Medicine and surgery. That means everything to do with small animals.
And what about the surgery? Was that something that you had always been interested in and always did?
I really like surgery, and I was very interested in surgery. It's just one part of being a veterinarian, though, and it's different than physicians, where very few physicians actually do surgery unless you're a surgeon. Well, if you're a general practitioner veterinarian, you do surgery almost every day, and I love that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in rural practice, we did a little bit of everything. I mean, I pinned bones, I took out kidneys, I did open chest surgery. I mean, you did it because you were it. There was nobody else anywhere near that you could send people to. And now I love practicing in Ithaca because I do routine surgeries, and for all the difficult technical surgery, I can refer it to somebody who's board certified and does surgery for a living.
Mm-hmm. Did you remember your first surgery on an animal? Was that a frightening experience?
I felt fairly well prepared by veterinary college, so it wasn't so much frightening. There were more frightening things than doing surgery. Surgery to me is, you know, like building something, and so that wasn't frightening. It was more frightening to try to decide, was I missing something in a diagnosis? Was I going to send this animal home and they were going to die when they got home because I missed an obstruction, rather than worrying about if I was doing a spay properly or, you know, that wasn't a real worry for me.
Yeah. And the thing about being a veterinary surgeon, I mean, you don't have the patient to tell you how they're feeling and whether it works.
Well, they can't speak, but they certainly can tell you how they're feeling, and I think that's a misconception. Mm. If you pay attention, animals can tell you a lot, and I listen to owners because owners often know way more than I do about how their animal is feeling. So I might do a normal physical exam on an animal, and yet I hear that they're sick, so, you know, I have to pay attention to that and then really try to see what the animal's saying. Mm-hmm. So,
You must have gone to vet school before. Years ago, people used to say that animals don't have feelings. Remember that in the olden days?
Yep.
Even scientists.
Yes.
Which was why they said we can experiment on them and not give them anesthetic. And
it's actually probably only in the last 15 years that things have really changed with pain control for animals. When we first learned surgery, and when I first went into practice, we never put an animal post-operatively on pain medication, and today that would be considered malpractice. In fact, there are several important lawsuits that have been brought recently for failure to give animals pain control after surgery.
Well, why did that change? Who changed that? We know Jane Goodall changed our feelings about primates, but how did this change in regard to giving animals pain?
That's a good question. I don't really know how that changed or why that changed. I think it's just that veterinary medicine has progressed just like human medicine has progressed. I mean, you know, the idea that you could do circumcision on a little boy and they used to think that it didn't hurt because they stopped crying in, you know, 5 minutes. And we would tail dock and remove the dew claws on puppies at 3 days of age and they would cry, but they would stop 10 seconds later. And so you would think, well, the pain is gone. But I think now we have more sophisticated research techniques, so we know that that's not true at all. And it's a bit disappointing that we sort of believed that all along anyway, because it doesn't make intuitive sense. And I have to say I'm a little bit embarrassed and ashamed of that, you know, because it didn't really make sense to me, but people told me it was true, so I believed it, and now we know it's not true.
Yeah, I know it's not true from having had animals all my life.
Right.
Yeah, I used to say, how can you say animals don't have feelings? Just step on that dog's tail and you get a reaction.
Right.
My goodness. Now, obviously caring for animals means also caring for the people that bring in the animals. Were you prepared in vet school for having to deal with the human beings and the emotions?
There were no courses that taught you really how to deal with people, no. So I didn't feel unprepared because I kind of knew that this was a profession where you had to have a lot of compassion and a lot of empathy and a face-to-face relationship with the owners. So I didn't feel unprepared in that way, but there was no education in it.
Mm.
It was just, you know, your intuition and your normal human
Compassion,
right.
And so you've learned from experience.
I've learned from experience. And I think now there are courses in, you know, the human companion animal bond and how to deal with the angry client, and I think they do get that education, mm-hmm. whereas for me, it more came by experience.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any major surprises in regard to the way people have behaved with animals, and you understand, you know, some of the emotions and angers? And
I can't say there have been any surprises. Mostly pleasant surprises that I'm sometimes amazed at choices that people make that I didn't expect them to make, or ways that I've been received. You know, an example would be that I didn't expect the Amish to receive me as well as they did, and they had no problem with that. Far less problem than some of the ordinary farmers that I went to who didn't want a woman coming on their farm.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Anne Shakespeare. She's a doctor of veterinary medicine. Let's talk a little bit about animal health care. I know there's been so much education, so many animal welfare groups. Why is it still an issue to get people to spay and neuter animals?
I think it's less of an issue than it was. I think people assume that their animal won't get pregnant if it's a female, or won't get out and breed if it's a male. I worked for a time for a practitioner who refused to castrate male dogs because he said the only control you really need is a leash. And of course that's true, but that doesn't really show a good understanding of human nature. So I think that it's more, you know, just a bit of, I'll put that off for the future, or I don't have the money right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the SPCA found that out when they would give people a discount for bringing their animal to a vet to get spayed or neutered, and very few people took them up on that. And now they spay and neuter all animals mm-hmm. before they leave there. There's no chance that somebody who said they're going to get it done actually doesn't get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way to approach it.
Yeah, and you do think it's important. Most vets and animal welfare organizations,
I think in this country it's extremely important, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in other countries where they have different rules about who can breed and how often you can breed, and there's penalties for having puppies and kittens that aren't purebred, it might be a different story. But in this country, there's huge pet overpopulation.
Oh, so absolutely.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah. And I still hear people, mainly young men, say they don't want to destroy their dog's sex life.
Yep.
Which is unbelievable to me.
Yeah. And, you know, we hear that a lot. And what I tell people is that if you have a male dog and you keep him intact and you're not going to allow him to breed, then you're really asking him to be a monk. He's going to have all the normal male desires. He's going to know when every female is in heat for 5 miles around. And unless you're going to let him loose to go breed, he's not going to ever have an opportunity to. And so think of the frustration that you as a man might feel. And that's often an argument that wins people over, and I think it's really true.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to keep an animal intact isn't really natural unless you're allowing them to engage in all of their natural activities, including reproduction,
And I know people who've let cats go because,
right. You
know, they don't get them neutered, and they spray in the house.
Right.
And people don't realize the connection between
right.
those two things.
Exactly.
As well. Yeah. Are there any major health issues that bring cats and dogs, particularly to vets, that could be prevented that you would like to educate people about?
Probably the biggest one is nutrition, and overnutrition in animals is a huge issue, that is often associated with diabetes. Mm-hmm. You see diabetes in cats and dogs, and it's way more prevalent in an obese animal. Joint disorders, arthritis, heart disease, you know, all the things that people get from being overweight also happen in animals, and that's probably the biggest one that's preventable.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you do about it? Are there thoughts about having classes through your vet? And
I don't know that we would offer that, but I think it's a matter of education. I think it's also a matter of marketing. You know, no dog food company or cat food company wants an animal to eat their food and be skinny. So I think they over-recommend an amount to feed. And I'm always dismayed by reading the back of a dog food package, for example, and finding out that you should feed a 60-pound dog 3 to 4 cups of food twice a day, which is a ridiculous amount for most animals, particularly ones that have been spayed or neutered and have a little bit lower metabolic rate.
Mm-hmm.
So education and...
And most people don't follow that. I mean, dogs and cats get table scraps, and people just
That's
think
right.
that they're being good parents.
That's right, and it's hard. I mean, it's one of the ways to show that you love an animal, and it's certainly understandable.
Mm-hmm. And did you see a lot of behavior problems with animals that you think perhaps have been neglected? I mean, how important is, especially with dogs, that kind of interaction between people and dogs?
Yeah, I don't know that behavior problems are neglected any longer. In fact, it's a specialty of veterinary medicine, animal behavior. So you can actually consult with a veterinary behaviorist for behavior problems. And we do some counseling for people for their behavior problems, but we refer most of them. So a dog that's aggressive, a dog that has separation anxiety, a cat that is aggressive, intercat aggression, house soiling, which is a behavioral problem. That's a huge behavioral problem in cats. There's a lot of attention on that now.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your feelings about the new drugging of animals for behavior problems?
I think it's great. I mean,
I think
it's part of a very successful field in veterinary medicine now. So it's not the only answer. And that's why when people say, my cat is spraying outside of the litter box and it's already been neutered and what can I do? And I know it's a behavioral problem. I generally refuse to just prescribe a medication because I think people need to understand where the problem's coming from and also modify their behavior to help the animal modify its behavior. And you certainly can't drug a dog that's has aggression or even one that has separation anxiety and expect it to be successful without behavior modification.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that there are drugs that can help with that, though.
Mm-hmm. And I just fear that you know, aggression is being caused by abuse, and you know, and so a vet doesn't know that, and they're prescribing a drug, and the animal becomes even more passive. And, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing.
Yeah,
kind of
you never know, but I don't think most aggression in dogs is caused by abuse. Mm. I think it's caused by a dog's natural tendencies and an owner's unawareness of that or refusal to do the training that is necessary so that a dog becomes really, you know, a good family member and isn't allowed to be the top dog. And that's what most cases of aggression are, I think.
You have to show that you're alpha dog.
Exactly. And that, in fact, that's what most of the behavior modification techniques are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any opinions about alternative medicines like acupuncture? I mean, you know, being from San Francisco, a lot of vets were treating, especially for pain.
Yes. Yes, and it's been a long time coming to that for me. I really needed to see the scientific evidence. I'm not one to just try something because it might not hurt, and why not try it? Mm-hmm. I really want to see evidence, and now the evidence is there for acupuncture as a pain medication, particularly for neurologic disorders. It's been shown to help, and then certain other alternative therapies as well, chiropractic for animals. But it's a fine line, and it's a difficult thing to know what's appropriate and what's not, and there are some veterinarians that specialize in alternative medicine. So if I have a client who's really interested in that, I try to refer them to somebody that has a focus of alternative medicine. I really am mostly a Western medicine person, and that's what I'm most comfortable with.
Is it because of cost, or you just don't think it would be effective? Or
I guess I worry that a lot of the evidence is anecdotal, and I don't feel right recommending that when I don't believe the evidence that has been put forth. If it hasn't passed what to me and what I learned as a scientific test, then I won't recommend it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you see in regard to the future for veterinary medicine? Is the sky the limit? Are there going to be transplants? Are there now?
Oh, sure, there are transplants now. There are kidney transplants, and it becomes quite an ethical issue. For example, a kidney transplant for a cat. I don't know that this is the case now, but it originally was required that you adopt an animal from the SPCA that was to be used as a transplant donor.
Mm.
So that animal would then have a home and wasn't just killed or euthanized after giving up its kidneys. It would be hopefully offered a normal life. However, the ethical question is, you're doing surgery and taking a healthy kidney from an animal that doesn't have a choice and doesn't have a say-so in it. And what are the ethics of that? It's a very good question.
That is a good question.
Even if you have, we had one owner who had two siblings, dogs, that were siblings, and one had kidney failure, and they flew this dog and its sibling out to California to have a kidney transplant, and the sibling was used as the donor. And so they owned that dog. They didn't have to adopt that dog, but you know, they made the decision for that dog that it was going to have an unnecessary surgery for it.
Those are questions.
Yeah, the sky, I think the sky is the limit, just like in human medicine, and it's really becoming a big issue because of the cost of that. Mm-hmm. And as a veterinarian, to try to inform people of all their options for diseases and for treatment, and not have them feel guilty for not choosing the most technical, the most expensive option.
Mm-hmm. Are we progressing in regard to cancer in animals?
Yeah, there's now oncologists, Cornell has a great oncology service that provides oncology consults to practicing veterinarians as well as treatment for animals with cancer. Mm-hmm. And so
Are they doing things like chemotherapy?
Of course.
Is it the
same? There's chemotherapy, there's radiation therapy, there's surgery, there is exactly what there is for people available for animals. And again, you have to pay attention to choices that the animal might or might not be okay with, and it's really hard to know. Some people will put their animal through amazing things for the hope for a cure that might be a really tiny chance because they'd put themselves through that, and other people find that, you know, an unfair choice.
Yeah. Do you find yourself just giving out information in regard to prolonging life, or do you try to sway people?
It's hard not to sway people. Yeah. I really, though, think my role is to just provide people with a number of alternatives. And there are some veterinarians and some people that are veterinary practice management consultants that insist that the proper attitude is for a veterinarian only to recommend the best. Mm. And I really disagree with that because I think that's not really informing people. I think that doesn't give people any choice at all. And there are many people that would choose less than the best because of financial concerns or, you know, whatever their bond with their animal is. And so I see my role as telling people you can do nothing, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, or you can do the last thing, which is the most expensive.
Mm-hmm. And when they say, what would you do? Are you able to?
Sometimes I'll tell them what I would do. I'm fairly practical, and the sky is not the limit for me. But most of the time I decline to answer that because I can't get inside their head and figure out what should I really say here and what's the best thing for them. Mm-hmm. So if I can put myself in their shoes easily, then I'll try to answer that question. But otherwise, it's not a fair question to ask.
Yeah.
And I tell them that, you know.
Yeah,
I'm me, and my dog is my dog, and your dog is your dog.
Yeah, so. I understand that. Well, Anne, we only have about a minute and a half left. Tell us how animals have enriched and changed your life. You work with them every day.
Yeah, I can't imagine a life without animals. We got our first dog when I was in second grade, and so I've had animals ever since, and I have three dogs and one cat now, and we have a hamster and fish in the house. And, you know, I think humans evolved with animals at least the last 30,000 years, and I think animals belong with people, and I think they have an incredible power to help people, enrich our lives, and I think we have the same incredible power to help animals. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing.
Yeah, I can understand that too. Animals are a major part of my life. Do you ever find yourself becoming attached to some of the clients that you work with in the vet?
Oh, very attached, and I'm not afraid of that at all. I mean, I love becoming attached to clients, and maybe, you know, 20 years ago, I would have tried to stay more aloof, but now I really love feeling like the people that I help are family.
Uh-huh. Well, Anne Shakespeare, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks
for
having me.
Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.